G'day and welcome to Psychobilly Australia, the podcast. This is podcast number 3. I'm your host, Wolfman Dan, and welcome. I'd really like to just say a big thank you to everyone that's had such nice things to say about what I've achieved so far. Yeah, it's been a little bit overwhelming, to be honest, because it's something I haven't done for a long, long time. So it's definitely something which I'm really enjoying getting back into the saddle and, you know, chatting to folk again. So my next guest is a guy I've known for quite a long time. He's a very good friend of mine as well. I'd like to introduce everyone to Mr. Dave Rumbler. How are you, my friend?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm doing well. You're looking well as well.
Yeah, thank you.
I just said well many times.
Well.
There you go. Anyway, look, it's one of the things that I really like to sort of find out from a lot of people that I have been, or the two people that I've talked to so far, is like, when did you fall in love with music? Where did that kind of start for you?
So for me, it was actually at about 10 years old.
Yeah.
which you'll find this funny because of what I've enlightened you to today. But first band, I was a drummer.
Yeah.
I had this old drum kit. You may remember a brand called Linco drum kits, which were the nastiest of the nasty in the 80s.
It does ring a bell, yes, yeah.
So I had a Linco drum kit that mum and dad had got from me from somewhere. I reckon it was Side of the Road or something like that.
Yeah.
I loved it. And then I had Rototoms, so they're real 80s, but didn't suit the style at all, but that's what I had.
Yep.
And played drums for a death metal band, basically doing Cannibal Corpse covers.
Wow, okay. That's interesting. Yeah. That's really interesting.
So couldn't even afford double kick, so I just had to do the one as fast as I could.
As quickly as you could, Oh, my foot's sore now.
So that was my first band ever.
Yeah. What was the band's name?
Oh, I couldn't even tell you, to be honest. I should remember, but I don't.
Yeah, that's okay. We can make up a name if you want. Yeah. Yeah, no. Okay, yeah, go on.
So I guess that was first actual band.
Yeah.
But music-wise, so I used to sit around with actually my cousin. His name's Raymond. He's you would know him from the scene.
Okay.
So we used to sit around at Dad's house with records of Madness, The Specials. Yep. They were the two main. We'd just play Madness and Specials over and
so
over.
So you listen to a lot of ska sort of like.
Yeah. He listened to a lot of ska reggae. Yeah. and then some like traditional Irish stuff too.
Oh, yeah. Like the Irish reels and all that sort of thing. Okay.
Yeah.
And like you mentioned your sort of parents there, so they were a big sort of influence. They kind of really sort of – did you sort of like get a bit of your sort of musical influence from them as well?
Yeah, so back in England, Dad was a drummer for – I think the band were called The Equals, which ended up being like quite a big band over there. But and then one of the members – I should remember what he went on to do, but it was massive.
Yeah, right, okay.
I may remember later and just
Yeah, that's all right. We can insert it later on. You can send me like audio at like 3 a.m. and it's like we'll just insert it later on.
Yeah, so once he left that band, he left that band and come to Australia to be with my mum. She was English too, but her family were coming over. so he was heavily into music, and then they were dance teachers for like rockabilly dance teachers for many years.
I knew this. I already knew this, but I guess a lot of folk probably wouldn't know that either.
No,
that's right. I'm not sure. I think I may have had a lesson from your dad point because my wife and I we used to do dancing like rockabilly dancing in Curry when they used to, when the RSL was still open. And I think you
would have been them.
There would have been them. Absolutely, yeah. I'm sure of it. So that's interesting. So so your dad was a drummer, and so you were a drummer then as well.
Yeah.
That's where you started out.
Well, it's funny though because it wasn't really related. It wasn't like Dad was a drummer, so I'll be a drummer. Mm-hmm. I didn't even really know that until, like, I was playing drums and he was like, oh, actually, I play drums for this band. And
So
just kind of went from that.
So you started with a metal band and then you were sort of listening to a lot of ska and all that sort of stuff.
Ska, and then that brought me into punk stuff. So got to see Sex Pistols in the 90s.
Oh, wow.
So that was amazing. Mm. And then just trying to think who else was seen through the 90s. But I went through a kind of metal phase as well.
Yep.
Pre that. So I was still always into the ska, reggae, punk stuff, but got into a metal phase and got to see Pantera live.
Wow.
Mouth for War tour, I think it was.
Okay, yeah.
Vulgar Display of Power tour. So then then it came over to kind of the more punk ska stuff.
So when did psychobilly start to show its face for you?
So I was in a band called Ivory Trail, which Jackson, we've got an engineer here behind us today.
Jackson, always hello, sees, my friend.
always sees our cassette. EP release that sat on my desk because it was the first release I ever did.
Yeah, right. You know? So, what was the name of the band again?
Ivory Child.
Ivory Child. I'm going to have to look that up.
Yeah, I don't know if you'll even find anything. Maybe you will.
I'll give it a shot.
Yeah. So that band was like, so the singer guitarist was right into Hendrix.
Okay.
So I got into that Hendrix Cream kind of thing for a while there. So that was kind of the style of that. But then I think my influence straight up put a bit of a punk edge to it. So it was kind of punk funk, I guess you would kind of call it.
Okay. Yeah, it's punk funk.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So it was it was funny. And then we did a load of band comps.
Okay, yep.
And we ended up doing quite well at the band comps, and there was a little Newcastle band that beat us back in the day. So we went through all and won all these things and got quite high up, and then this band kind of knocked us off, and they were called Silverchair.
Got absolutely knocked down by nobodies. Yeah. Jeez, I guess you can't feel too bad about that though, considering what they achieved.
Even at the time, like, obviously you're in a band and you love what you do, you got passion, you're like, we're the next best thing.
Yeah.
And they were the better band.
Yeah.
Like, we watched them and we're just like, this is amazing. We're watching something unfold here that's going to be huge.
So you could actually see, like, you know, these guys are probably going to go somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, it was quite obvious back in those days.
I'm guessing.
That's incredible. That's cool. So you got beaten by Silverchair.
We did.
Yeah.
We did. Yeah. The better guys.
Yeah. And so how do you sort of move on from there?
So from that, I still was like, yep, this band, you know, it's going to go. We ended up having a meeting with EMI.
Okay, yeah.
So major label meeting at 14 we were. We were already starting to tour at 14. that's who signed Silverchair. And basically what we were doing was fairly obscure.
Yep, yep.
And especially for 14-year-olds. So they were basically like, well, they said to us, what you guys are doing is 10 years off.
Right, okay.
So they're like,
so you're ahead of your time.
We're ahead of our time, basically.
Yeah, right, okay.
So, which you can kind of think of bands after that as well, and, you know, you get Rage Against the Machine, all that kind of stuff.
Yep.
Which probably weren't 10 years after, but they weren't long after.
They weren't too far. So they weren't too far off the mark.
No.
They knew what they were talking about.
Yeah, yeah. But that was when I started to, so mum and dad were dancing. I was dancing back then as well and competing and stuff like that.
I did not know about that.
I did not know about that, Dave.
That's not something you tell everyone, is it?
Nah. Well, I just did though.
Oh, no.
and just the more kind of, so we're going to rockabilly venues every week.
Yeah.
And then I started to get quite into it, so I would go down to Sydney, and there's a couple called Pete and Tracy, old rockers, mm-hmm. That used to sneak us into the original Hollywood Club. Just trying to think what other original rockabilly venues they'd sneak us into, and we'd watch all the rockabilly gigs.
Okay,
so yeah. We were about 15 at that age.
Yeah, right. And what were some of the bands that were sort of kicking about in those days?
So Wes and the Sonic Aces, they were going. Yep. Just don't think who else is around. I should remember.
That's okay. We're not exactly spring chickens anymore, Dave.
No.
So
no.
It's okay that our memory fails us sometimes.
Mine does a lot.
It fails me so often. Why do I do it? Anyway, so you were going to like all these rockabilly clubs and seeing bands like Wes and
a lot of the original bands,
yeah,
you know, the original Australian kind of that resurgence of rockabilly.
Yeah, right.
So it's good, all these full venues. Mm-hmm. I was a 14-year-old kid in there.
Yeah.
I looked older anyway, so I never got kicked out. I just got snuck in, which was cool.
Yeah, that's the best way to get into pubs, actually. Yeah.
And then, so obviously that got me a love for that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And then the next thing, so I ended up leaving Ivory Trail because it just, once I got this new love, it wasn't filling that.
Yeah.
That thing I loved.
Yeah, you know, you had an itch that you wanted to scratch.
And we ended up doing one psychobilly song in that band
as well. Yeah.
But they were like, look, we don't really like that stuff, so let's just leave it at the one. So it kind of cemented the decision for me.
Yeah.
It's like, all right, you know.
No, I love this stuff.
I love this stuff. Yeah. So bought a double bass and just hammered at it to learn it.
So you taught yourself how to play the bass?
I had lessons for electric, but I think it was either 4 or 6 lessons I did.
So it wasn't many.
Wasn't many.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was basically just teaching me songs as they kind of normally do.
Yeah.
Especially
scales,
back in the 90s.
Scales and stuff, who needs those?
Yeah, yeah. So it was just songs and I was like, I can work these songs out anyway.
Yeah.
It's easy.
Yeah.
So obviously I had an ear for it.
You had
then.
A bit of a gift for it. Yeah, so you had an ear for the sound. Yeah.
So bought a double bass, got to learning that. And their memory is not great, but it was either one of two bands I started with. So your last podcast you were talking to Reckless.
Correct, yeah.
And he was in a band with Stu.
Yep.
So the original band that kind of did all the makeup. Mm-hmm. I was in with Stu called Attack of the 30-Foot She Monster.
Attack of the 30-Foot She Monster. That is such a cool name for a band.
Yeah. So we did a heap of Sydney shows.
Yeah.
Just trying to think of some of the bands we opened up for, but it was like the Foves or Forves, whatever.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I think the Clouds. Mm-hmm. So these like Australian kind of softer bands.
Yeah.
But we were opening up for these
as a psychobilly band, all decked out in makeup and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
That's cool.
So there was a stage where we couldn't find a drummer that was into it.
Yeah.
So we had like a Boss 808 drum machine was our drummer.
Okay, yeah.
So we'd hit that and play to it.
At least they're not going to interrupt you as you're trying to tune.
That's right. And they can change a light bulb.
Oh, we love our drummers. Yeah.
But then the other band was called 8-Ball Baby.
I've heard of 8-Ball Baby. Yeah.
So that band was more of a cover band anyway, but we were doing all these kind of raucous rockabilly songs, which wasn't really done then.
Yeah.
Everything was quite polished and pretty tame.
Yeah, as rockabilly has become over the years.
So this band was really raucous and, you know, so that was where I kind of got my love for the raucous side of rockabilly instead of the polished side, you know.
Yeah.
So that more punk end. Still to this day, you know, that's my thoughts of where punk and metal came from, is that early rockabilly stuff.
Absolutely.
So that was where it all sat, you know. That was where I'd already been anyway, and this kind of fed into that.
Yeah.
But, you know, like a drug, you want more and more, you want harder and harder, and that's where the psychobilly...
That doesn't just apply to music as well. There are other things that it applies to that you may have to be a bit older to understand. But yes, no, so April, you're an 8-ball baby, is that right? And then when did the Casino Rumblers start? Or how did that start, actually?
So in between there I had... I was in Wes on the Sonic Aces.
Yep.
So
were you playing bass?
Playing bass for them. Yep. So, and that's where I started to really, really gig hard. Mm-hmm. So we were doing four nights a week and then one night a week rehearsal Liverpool. And I was living Central Coast. So
playing four shows and rehearsing
in Liverpool.
That's incredible. And you're living in Liverpool as well.
No, that's where we're rehearsing.
That's where you were rehearsing.
Yeah.
Whereabouts were you living?
I was living at Tookley on the Central Coast, north end of Central Coast.
Okay. I used to live in Tookley as well.
Yeah.
So yeah, everyone's, you know. It turns out everyone's lived in Tookley at some point. that is quite the schedule.
Yeah, it was full on. And then... For a while there, I was still, I'm trying to think, I think I was still in 8-Ball Baby as well.
Mm.
But that band wasn't gigging so much then.
Yeah.
I did a fair few years with Wes. So what would I have been then? Maybe 3 or 4 years with Wes.
Mm-hmm.
And then same kind of thing. We were doing amazing gigs, toured Europe, did all this stuff, you know.
But, wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, but this kind of love for the harder edge of music was still there.
Yeah.
And it's funny because, so then the Casino Rumblers start, but, it's funny because people kind of always thought of us as this ska band.
Yeah.
And we really weren't. It was just raucous rockabilly, psychobilly, but with a horn section. So.
Yeah.
My original idea of that was, so originally it was from the Amazing Royal Crowns.
Yes,
which changed their name to the Amazing Crowns.
Mm-hmm, yep.
But there's one song that they do called Do the Devil.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that was where I was like, that's so good. Like, I love the upbeat of ska.
Yeah.
But I didn't want that involved at all. But... you know, still this love for horn sections and stuff like that. So that was where it kind of come about. And then obviously the Specials and Madness, all the horn sections are pretty sedate when you break it down, you know.
Yeah.
It's awesome, but it's kind of sedate.
Yeah.
So the horn lines were really inspired by Voodoo Glow Skulls.
Man, if no one has listened to the Voodoo Glow Skulls, you are missing out on something
so
special. They're incredible. I absolutely love their music, and you know, and I can definitely hear that. I can definitely hear that in your music as well. It's like I can hear that influence in there, you know.
Yeah.
And so when you did start the Casino Rumblers, did you have an idea of the sort of sound you wanted? Because we've had a conversation about, you know, the beginnings of the Casino Rumblers, and from memory you were sort of contemplating going that old school sound of psychobilly at some point. Is that right? Am I thinking right?
Yes. Yeah. Originally it was going to be kind of that 80s
sort of Batmobile-y kind of thing. Yeah, Frenzy. Yeah.
But it was just straight away it wasn't enough.
Yeah.
Wasn't heavy enough for me,
you
know, and was like, I really like this. So, you know, people that kind of love that music will know that they probably use a Fender amp, quite clean, really bright, really punchy.
Mm-hmm.
There's members of bands and stuff that even use like a Roland Jazz Chorus, which is a solid state amp, not a valve amp. So super clean, you know, which I loved. But I wanted heavier.
It wasn't enough.
It wasn't enough. So I was like, you know, so the first guitarist, I was like, buy a Marshall stack.
Yeah.
So it's like, all right, cool. So he bought a Marshall stack.
Yeah.
And that was
sent you the
that
bill.
Was where, and that was where our original sound came from.
Okay, yeah.
It was like, no, I want a stack. I want this. I want this to hit people in the face so hard yeah. when we play live.
Mm-hmm. And you do that really, really well.
Yeah.
It's one of the things I always remember as like watching your band play in Newcastle. My brain fails me at the moment, but there was this pub that used to put bands on upstairs.
That was the Lucky.
I felt lucky being there, and that was something else because that was such a small space, yeah. and that sound just absolutely brutally, yeah. you know, smacked you in the face, and I freaking loved it.
Yeah,
you know, being a younger guy as well, I was like 19 or whatever it was at the stage, and I kind of, at that point, I was still sort of discovering what I really, really enjoyed.
What it was, yeah.
Yeah, and what it was. And previously I've said, you know, like one of my first sort of real sort of tastes of psychobilly came from The Living End. And like you, I just wanted to hear something faster.
Yeah.
I wanted to hear that heaviness. And that's where psychobilly for me really caught my attention.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's one of those things that no one else is freaking doing as well.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, and I think that's one of the allures to it as well. It's like everyone else is like, you can have a punk band, you know, and sound absolutely terrible.
Yeah.
And that's what punk is sometimes. Yeah, that's fine. Right. But when it comes to this kind of stuff, it has that brutality, but there's still that element of cleanliness in there as well.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
You know, and that's what I love too. And so in the beginning, sort of like, how many people were in the band?
Good question. Let me count because there was way too many.
Dave's got enough fingers, I think. You can borrow mine if you need to.
I think it was a 9-piece.
A 9-piece.
I think it was. There was 2 horns.
Yeah.
We had a bongo, percussionist, drummer,
mm-hmm.
guitarist, bass. No, so it must have been 7. Yeah, it was 7, and then we added another horn.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
okay.
So 7 to 8 when we first started. So there was 2 vocalists originally.
That would have been so hard to organise. I know what it's like just to organise 3 guys.
Yeah, it was a
nightmare. It would have been an absolute nightmare.
Yeah. And so we had a guy, I don't know if you know Kane, big guy.
Sounds familiar, yeah.
So he doesn't go to gigs anymore,
mm-hmm.
still into all that stuff.
Yeah.
Probably more into his metal these days, but so he was like an old, he was mixed between a psychobilly and oi.
Okay,
you
know? Yep.
So he started losing his hair early, so it was shaved,
mm-hmm.
braces, but then like, you know.
He had the look.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
But he was kind of, wasn't a great vocalist.
Okay.
But he was a good hype man. So he'd often come out with a mouthful of fake blood. First thing he'd do is like punch himself in the face and the fake blood would go over the crowd.
So a bit of theatrics.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. That's all right. A bit full on, but cool.
Yeah.
I can imagine. And so how long had it been like since you decided, you know what, we're actually going to record something now?
I recorded straight away.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so
you tend to do that with a lot of your bands, I've noticed.
Yeah, yeah. Like, if I decide I'm going to do something, I'll just hammer and do it.
Yeah.
Covers, not so much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have a band called Club Congo and the Piranha Tamers.
Yeah.
We're starting to do some original stuff now, but it was mainly my band for the kind of club circuit. Keep playing.
Yep.
As a double bass player now, I don't like to talk myself up, but I would like to say I'm a professional player.
Mm-hmm.
Keeping those gigs every weekend just to keep that technique up. And
yeah.
So these other bands through the years, which I've done, I don't know, maybe 20 of, keep that going.
Keep that
so
going,
I generally don't record those.
Yeah.
But any of the kind of bands that
the original kind of stuff
straight in record.
Yeah.
Whether it's demos and then re-record.
Yeah.
Rumblers did release their first demo, which would be very hard to get now.
Mm-hmm.
We did find a copy of it not long ago because we're up here in my studio, but we got heaps of old Rumblers gear up here, newspaper clippings, all this stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And found the original thing, which was, it was released on, do you remember those mini CDs you used to get?
Yes, I do, yeah. It was released on that,
It was released on that.
how many songs did those things hold? I can't remember.
Three.
Three songs. Yeah. So it was essentially like a single sort of thing. Just, okay. Wow, that brings back memories of losing them. Because I was so small. It's so, what do you think was probably one of the more challenging things for you back in those days? Like, even today, you know, what are some of the challenges that you faced earlier on that you may still be facing these days?
I guess dealing with promoters, dealing with musicians.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Generally what I like, so the Rumblers went through, it was 31 members.
Many. Yeah.
And look, I would like to think I'm a pretty easygoing person.
I think you are. I'm pretty sure Jackson thinks so as well, you know. Sorry about that, mate.
I gave people, so we used to tour pretty hard.
Yeah.
So I used to give people about 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned this, you know, later on.
You learn it in time, you know, yeah. It's like,
you give people about 3 years of going on tour, sleeping in vans, sleeping in hostels or sleeping in, you know, Joe's whatever down in Melbourne and or all these different accommodation things that we've had that never bothered me, you know. Because I slept, actually it was when I was with Wes, I think it was, I slept in Melbourne in winter in a bathtub with a broken leg. It's not even a joke. It's just, it was this party house, and it was the last spot left. And I was like, well, if I sleep there, because I broke my leg on the last gig.
Okay, yeah.
Kept touring, and I was like, at least I can kind of lift my leg up and put it on the thing of the bath. So that's where I slept.
I was going to ask you, do you have any funny stories from the road? But that's already pretty funny.
Yeah, that's pretty funny. I have a lot.
I imagine you would. Yeah, because you've done a lot of touring. And as you said, you've been overseas as well. I can imagine some pretty interesting things would happen on the road.
Yeah, there's a good European story. Do you want me to give it to you
Let's
now?
Let's do it. Yes, right. Absolutely. I want to hear it, man.
So this is with Wes and the Sonic Aces.
Yeah.
So we had a guitarist back then that he was great at snoring.
Okay.
He was a master.
Yeah.
And it was like, I think we're in Sweden, so it was kind of, or Finland actually.
Same thing.
Towards the end of the tour.
Mm.
He'd been snoring this whole time.
Yeah.
And there's this one last gig, and the next day we're all driving back to Germany. So we had to drive all the way from Sweden, all the way back through Europe to Germany, jump on our plane.
Yeah.
And he's straight away, he's out.
He's one of those guys that can just fall asleep on it like that.
Lays down.
I hate those
people.
There
he goes.
Yeah.
And the drummer was just like, I'm taking first shift. This guy has to fucking stop snoring. So I hear him kind of huffing and puffing and, you know, trying to turn over and earplugs. Earplugs didn't stop this guy. Anyway, so remember the old, so this would have been late 90s, I think it was, those old cane chairs that used to be in all the hotel rooms.
Yeah, and they make an absolute racket when you sit on them. Yeah.
So he picks up one of them, starts hitting the guitar.
He starts hitting with a chair.
Does not wake up.
Does not wake up. No. He was literally copping a cane.
copping a caning, So he's like, this ain't working. And he's on one of those, again, you remember the 90s, they had those fold-out beds that used to be on wheels.
Oh, they were terrible.
Yeah, they were terrible. So it was on wheels.
Mm-hmm.
So he's gone, well, fuck this, and pushes him out in the hallway.
Yeah.
Just out the front of our door, leaves him there.
Just leaves him there.
So he's still asleep, slept through all of this.
Yeah, right.
And we're like, holy shit, this is fixed. He can sleep out there.
Yeah.
Perfect. So then what happens, we kind of, I don't know, it was about 4 o'clock.
Mm.
these young girls come home from there, whatever they're doing, you know. Yeah. So they're they see this half naked guy laying on this bed on wheels. So first they go and draw penises all over his face.
As you do. That's a natural thing you do, yeah.
So we kind of hear him giggling and look out and, you know, like, oh, shit, what do we do? He's just slept through the whole thing still. We're just like, oh, well, he'll wash it off in the morning.
Yeah.
Go back to sleep. They go to their room. They must, you know, be on something that keeps them awake. And so they come out. So they come out and decide it would be an awesome idea if they race him. So up this hallway of this hotel, they're racing him.
Yeah, right.
So we go out and there's like, you see him going past.
That's hilarious. He's still asleep.
Still asleep.
Oh, that's incredible.
So they put him nicely to sleep in the lift, send him down.
So then, so he can annoy everyone floor by floor. Yeah.
So he's still asleep.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Stays in there.
Yeah.
And then we we get woken up to the cleaner, bang, 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 bang on the door. This guy with penis on his face with this little little old cleaner and he's fuming.
Oh, that's great.
So that was a good one.
I was hoping for a good story, and that is definitely a good one.
Yeah, I got plenty of those.
I imagine you would, Dave. I imagine you would. And look, how long have you guys been around for now? The Rumbas, it's in excess of 20 years, isn't it?
Yeah, so I think I'm trying to think now whether it was 99 or 2000 we started. So it's either one of those years. I can never get it right. Mm. So our first gig, I think, was New Year's Eve of 2000.
Okay, yep.
So I think that's when it was. That rings a bell. So,
yeah.
You know, the Y2K, we all thought we were going to die, that kind of thing.
Man, we feel stupid after that, don't we? Yeah. That was such an idiotic thing that went on.
Yeah.
I heard the other day some referred to the late 90s as the late 1900s.
Yeah,
doesn't that make you feel old?
Yeah.
It's technically correct, but it makes you feel so old.
Yeah. Yeah, we're living in the 20s now.
Yeah, I know, right? Isn't it? All the flappers are going to come back soon. I really hope they do. I want to get rid of mullets.
Yeah.
My goodness, I'm sick and tired of seeing those damn things.
Especially living in Curry.
Oh, we've got the Curry. Here in Curry, we have what's called Mullet Fest. And it was entertaining the first year.
Yeah.
But now it's just, I don't know. It's not my thing. Let's just put it that way. So what can we expect from the Rumblers?
The Rumblers are never broke up.
Yeah.
But I did get tired of that touring.
Yeah.
And organising that many musicians.
Yeah.
And especially those musicians had been touring with me for years. So there really needs to be some good money for them to want to do that these days.
Of course, you know, you've been doing it for a long time. I don't think it's too much to ask, you know, for a little bit of coin when you've been doing it for a while.
But as you know, that's never really around. So
no.
Look, basically what we do now is if there's like a good gig now, we'll rehearse and we'll do it.
Yep.
We're slowly working on an album.
Mm-hmm.
We started that pre-COVID.
Yeah.
Or actually, no, in the middle of the COVID, I
remember
think it
that.
Was.
Yeah.
So that's still sitting there and that's going to get released. There was also two albums that actually broke the band up.
Yeah.
Separately. So recording's a hard thing when there's not much money. You need to put in the time.
And recording is not cheap, especially when you don't have a recording studio.
Yeah.
You know, it's like if you need to go in and just record like one or two songs, A, you've got to try and get everyone there.
Yeah.
And then B, it costs a fair bit of money to just record.
Yeah, well, I think that first album, like we did cheaper tracking.
Yeah.
So we tracked it like a cheaper studio.
Mm-hmm.
Still cost us a fair bit.
Yeah.
And then did all mixing, mastering at 301, in Sydney. So
okay, yeah,
the kind of biggest studio there was through the 2000s. So probably yeah. isn't now, but I'd say it's still up there. But I think that cost us about $20,000, and that was 2005. We was recording that.
Mm. And that's just to record. Then you've got to think about the mediums that you want to then release your music on. Because yep. back in those days, you know, there was Napster and all that kind of stuff, but yep. it wasn't. There wasn't streaming services like there are today, you know. And
yeah,
and so your main way of getting your music out there was through the CDs that you would sell at, you know, gigs.
Yeah,
and stuff
that's
like
right.
That.
We were lucky then, and got signed. For yeah. that record,
yeah.
Through Sound System,
yeah,
which is Pete Walker's label,
yeah, and you also got sponsored by the Bass Shop as well in Sydney, isn't that right? Yeah,
yeah, I was sponsored for years by the Bass Shop.
Yeah, I remember that, and I thought, wow, that's cool. Being a younger guy, I thought, hey, that's pretty sweet.
Yeah, it was good. And yeah, just, you know, always have the shirt on at gigs, and
yep.
or I'd always actually change into that after gigs.
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
and just send people his way.
Yeah,
you know, I'm pretty sure I sent a load of people there, but you never know. But that was always a good thing.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And then we signed with JB Hi-Fi as well. So
okay, I didn't know they had their own label.
No. So what it is. You'll do this thing where I think we put their logo on the album or something like that.
Okay.
And that got us so many weeks of being the top shelf artist.
Okay, right.
So that got us like a load of Triple J airplay and
yeah, okay. Stuff back like when that. Back when lots of people really enjoyed Triple
yeah.
J.
Yeah. Well, and that was the thing. That was what you
yeah.
That was where you headed for.
Well,
in this
right.
country was Triple J.
Triple J. Yeah, that you know you had done something right when you got your song played on Triple J.
Yeah.
You know, and so, and I guess another thing which, you know, a lot of people would not know, and you alluded to it earlier, is you've got your own recording studio. In fact, it's
I
not
do.
Just a recording studio. You've created this absolutely wonderful space called the Cabin Collective.
I have.
I've been coming here for years. I came here, you know, even before Dave actually put everything together. Dave came to me and told me about this wonderful idea, and I thought, man, I really hope you can pull this off,
yeah.
And because it was a massive.
You've watched me pull things off before.
I have, so, yeah. And I've had to wipe my face after. But but this was the way you sort of described it. That you kind of wanted it to be a live venue. You wanted it to be a tattoo shop and a coffee shop as well. Because well, we all love coffee around here.
Yeah, we're old.
We need coffee, you know. And so. Describe a little bit about this place and what your sort of where it kind of, you know, started for you. How did you come up with the freaking idea in the first place, man? This is unreal.
Yeah, well, you know me and my brain more than a lot of people.
Yeah.
super busy brain. So a part of that actually is I have Tourette's and OCD.
Yeah.
So it drives the way I think and articulate my projects, all of that kind of stuff.
Mm.
So I've been working tattoo shops for years as a tattooer, which we haven't said yet, but yeah. That I think I'm up to 19 years this year tattooing as well.
Wow. You must have really sore back.
Yes. But just kind of, you know, in the chair all these days thinking and then thinking about gigs and what gigs I've got coming up because I tattoo during the day, play at night.
Yeah.
Pretty well 4 nights a week.
Mm-hmm.
And then was like, I want to do this all in one place.
Yeah.
And by saying that, I didn't want to gig at my venue every night. That
yeah.
would, you know, that's not the idea. But I had a little recording studio back then. It was quite tiny. So all of that kind of stuff, I just kept putting all these ideas. And so the original kind of brain incarnation of this thing was like an old factory with with a massive mezzanine that looked down on the tattooing.
Mm-hmm.
So the tattooing would be in the centre.
Yeah.
And there'd be all these little pockets upstairs of cool shit, basically. Yeah. So mm-hmm. I wanted a barber up there. I wanted a coffee shop up there. And you could walk around this mezzanine, kind of like a small shopping centre kind of thing.
Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you have your coffee, you can watch your tattoos getting done, and it was just cool, hang out.
Spit on people.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Have old motorbikes down there and, you know, stuff like that.
Mm.
So basically that's what I've done.
Yeah, it is.
The thing in my mind originally with that old factory kind of thing is nearly you could not get that kind of thing and not pay, you know, ridiculous amount. But what we've got is this cool old early 1900s, the original 1900s, not the.
I regret bringing that up now.
early 1900s building that was originally a service station.
Yeah.
We have a mezzanine, but that's our studio.
Yeah.
But downstairs is tattoo shop primarily. Mm-hmm. That's our income.
Yeah.
That's kind of what drives everything. I think we're up to 8 full-time tattooers and 3
apprentices.
Apprentices.
Yeah.
Now.
Mm.
4 apprentices now.
4 apprentices now.
4 apprentices now.
That is incredible.
Yeah. And then live music. Which that's been a really hard one, and as you know, Dan worked for us for a little while trying to orchestrate the gigs and stuff like that.
Yeah,
which we've kind of pulled back a little bit on at the moment.
Mm.
Just COVID finances, like as in the housing market is gone ridiculous.
It's ridiculous.
People are pulling back on all those things.
Yeah.
So our gigs are kind of, I don't like people coming to play for free here.
Yeah.
So I'd like to give them, at least 100 a member.
Yeah.
For whoever plays.
Absolutely, yeah.
And it's harder and harder to do and, I've got to work out my morals there. And
yeah.
But live music venue, then we took over next door's building, which is probably a 1920s building.
Okay.
That'd be older. No, it'd be older than this building.
Mm-hmm.
So it'd be late 1800s building that one.
Wow, okay.
And that's got barbers and hairdressers in as well.
Yeah. So, this it's an absolutely incredible space because not only does it have all this incredibly cool stuff, but if you've created an environment that, everyone feels comfortable in, no matter who you are, you could be just any Joe Smo off the street and you'll come in here and you'll just feel comfort straight away because it has that atmosphere.
Yeah.
It's sort of got all these lovely sort of trinkets around the place and, beautiful artwork. And to me, the sound of tattoo guns going all the time is just relaxing.
Yeah.
In a way. It's kind of like that white noise when you're a baby.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just like.
Which is a bit quieter these days than it used to be.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
But, It is an absolutely wonderful space that you have created, and I absolutely encourage anyone, if you come to Maitland, you have got to drop in here and have a coffee at least and then get a haircut, maybe a tattoo. But at the very least, you've got to drop by and have a coffee because Dave actually, it doesn't just get in any old coffee beans, do you?
No, we don't.
You do something very different that, you're pretty much what the only person in Australia that
only,
does it.
Only one.
You're the only person that roasts your own coffee beans over an open fire. Is that right?
Yep. So,
how'd that idea come around?
Yeah. Well, there's another big story.
Yeah, I like that. We're going to be here for a while. I may have to break this up into a couple of segments. I think that's okay.
All right. So, a part of the way my brain works is so I actually got into. So it came around from photography, which makes no sense yet.
A little while ago, I created a list for Dave of all the things that he has done over the years. And I think I stopped at about 15 different things.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, and because...
There's more to add now.
There's far out. I'm going to have to find the list. But continue where you were. Sorry, I interrupted.
Yeah, so you got... Heavily into photography. And, got quite good at it.
Mm-hmm.
Was releasing prints and stuff like that. And I really liked landscape over kind of portrait photography. Mm-hmm. I did portrait for weddings and stuff like that, but what I loved is like obscure landscape stuff and real like epic style landscapes. So I got into that, which then to get better and better landscapes in this style that I liked, I had to go further into the bush.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, all right, well, I have to carry so much gear and I can't get cars in. How do I do this?
Yeah.
So I started to get right into survival stuff.
Yep.
And the original idea of getting into the survival stuff was being able to take less gear if I kind of knew how to make stuff. And
yeah.
So I learned.
You're probably the first survivalist that hasn't come from a prepper point of view.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I learned all those survival skills and then became a survival instructor.
Yep.
So taught for this company in the States and I used to film. So obviously it came from photography, so I used to film for this TV channel over in the States. So I'm over there somewhere doing my survival stuff.
Is that weird?
Yeah, I guess so.
It's a little bit weird knowing that, you know. Because I kind of find it weird because I did a little bit for Tattoo Ink TV, I think it was, all those years ago, and it was for Autumn Fest.
Yeah.
And we interviewed, I can't remember who we sort of interviewed, but we interviewed some people and people have watched that all over the world, and I kind of find that really weird.
That,
you know, that people
are watching it.
People are watching me do this weird interview with people and they probably don't even understand what I'm saying.
Yeah, you know.
I don't know. There's something weird about that. I don't know what it is. Yeah.
Yeah, so that led into, again, taking less and less gear, but I loved me coffee. So I used to go out and film and I didn't always go super deep into wilderness for the filming.
Mm-hmm.
I would still go into wilderness areas and I'd have to drive there and then probably hike for a bit. But, you know, I wanted to take coffee so I could have coffee in the morning. So I got a little...
Not just a Nescafe nonsense sort of thing. No, you got to have the good stuff.
Got to have the good stuff. So, and then I was like, how about if I just have green beans and I learn how to roast them and then it won't go off because that stuff doesn't go off. So that's what I did. I found a company that supplied green beans.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned how to roast them.
Yeah.
And I would roast them and do that as a part of the filming and that kind of stuff. And then learned how to roast coffee and then upscaled. And now we supply the cafe doing that.
Isn't that cool? It all just started out in the bush.
Yeah, literally. Yeah,
it just started out in the bush, and you just decided to, you know, instead of going out and buying, buying sort of pre-roasted sort of beans, you decided to do it yourself. There's something really artisan about that in a way. I love that word.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely delicious coffee. I come here at least once or twice a week.
Yeah.
I think. Yeah. And I always have at least one coffee. I'm buzzing after, but, you know, it's absolutely delicious. So you've done a really good thing with this, you know.
Yeah, like it. I spent heaps of time getting that right out there.
Yeah.
And then I even used to, wouldn't take a grinder, so all I'd take is like a bandana and I'd actually carve out a stick to do all the grinding. So I'd carve out a little kind of part of a bowl.
Okay.
And then would put the beans in that and I'd actually in my handkerchief thing, my bandana.
Yeah.
And I'd grind it all in that and everything.
Wow. So really real bare basics, isn't it? Yeah. No, that's cool.
Enjoyed it though.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely. Yeah, I can see the passion. Basically. Yeah. I've watched the passion from afar over the years because, you know, I've known it, and a lot of people that do sort of know it, is that you do not sit still. You have got to be doing something all the time. So today, if you don't mind me saying, it's like today I arrived today and Dave told me about all this stuff. It was your freaking day off, man. You're supposed to be relaxing, not recording some absolutely brutal metal. That's all I'm going to say about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I want you to release that and absolutely blow people's faces away.
We just won't say the name.
Okay, we won't say that. We'll say the mystery band then.
Yeah.
So you've been working on this mystery band. You've been keeping a real good secret too, I've got to say that.
Yeah. So I guess the love for that kind of real, real brutal death metal stuff has never gone.
Yeah.
I'd say the whole rockabilly and punk vibe has been my heart.
Yeah.
And always has and always will.
Always will be.
But this kind of original love for this real brutal early 90s.
What is it about the brutalness that you like?
I don't know. I think it's just the extreme, you know. I like...
It's chaotic, isn't
it? It's chaotic and...
Like your brain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I reckon that's why.
Yeah, it's... Yeah. Wow, I think I just came up with something profound. Have you ever thought of combining the two, like your love for metal and psychobilly? Because it does exist.
Yeah, well, that's right. Well, actually, going back to at the start of this conversation, they need a shout-out, I think, is the Fireballs.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
So, obviously, and Aaron said the same thing.
Yeah.
Reckless said the same thing.
He won't mind you saying his first name.
You know, those guys did inspire.
Yeah.
You know.
They inspired a lot of people.
Yeah. And Matt Black's kind of...
He's on my radar.
Yeah.
He's on my radar to talk to because I reckon that guy is going to have some killer stories.
Yeah.
So he's definitely... some people have messaged me and actually said, you know what, Matt Black would be absolutely fantastic for this podcast, and I completely agree.
Yeah.
That would be absolutely brilliant. But, you know, right now, we are sitting up in your studio, and over the years you've collected some incredible stuff.
You know? So... Look, the idea of this studio, I guess, is we're not super high-end studio, as in like, you know, million-dollar buildings.
Yeah, it's not like super clean, and it's not it's got a heart, this place.
Yeah.
And go on.
So what I can see this studio being is kind of people that really, really do want artisan kind of sound. They do want really good sound, not just what 301 produces or whatever these big studios produce that obviously sounds amazing.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's going through
$1 million
worth of gear in a million-dollar room with an engineer that is charging
$1 million
now. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And obviously it's going to sound good.
Yeah.
I think what we're doing is more heart-based. but we've stocked to this studio to the hilt, so and we're not stopping here either. So, I think we're up to.
I'm scared.
So is my wife.
Yeah.
G'day,
Brie.
I think we're up to 15 kits. So we have some lower end kits that we can kind of, if we're going to try anything, or you know, we want to break a skin and get this unique sound, whatever it is, doesn't matter.
Yeah,
we've got those up to some really high end kits that people can basically use. So what I'm looking at with this studio is people coming in with their sound, but they want to experiment with more sound,
and they may not have the equipment to do it themselves.
So, guitar amps are up to what would we be, Jackson? 20. Over 20
tube guitar amps. Wow.
All different, some metal end, some super 20s sounding, everything in the middle, some punk stuff, some Marshalls.
Yeah.
So we've got a pretty wide scope, but I think I've got a wide kind of like my influences are really wide as well.
Yeah.
So I think I can do all of those things that fit in there justice.
It's not like you've got one speciality. It's like you've got a really broad range of things that you enjoy listening to. And so, you know,
so
you've developed your ear
this.
Over that, over that sort of thing. Yeah.
And then, so bass amps, obviously I'm a double bass player. So I think there's about 15 bass amps there as well.
I'm going to have to borrow one someday. I haven't got my own yet.
And then we've got some unique instruments around as well. Guitar-wise, we'd be up to 30.
One recently that was pinstriped by the amazing artist that is Hot Rod Walt.
It was, yeah.
What a privilege I would have been to be on the stage with him, because that guy is incredible.
Yeah, he's, you know, well, he said at the last kind of gig, he's getting ready to go to bed to then get up at 4 a.m. and get on his plane, and he's like, I've got more family now.
Oh.
So it was, you know, this heartwarming thing. We all had a cry. It was great.
Did you hug?
We did.
Oh, that's beautiful.
I got photos.
You got, you got to sell them on OnlyFans. So what can we expect? We've got this mystery metal band coming. What can we sort of expect, in the way of psychobilly from you?
Look, I think we're going to chip away at this Rumblers album.
Yep.
And I think I'm going to release it in like a side A and side B.
Okay, yep.
I'm also going to dig up everything that we recorded and mix it to the extent that we can, depending on what format we can find it.
Yeah.
Because we had a hard drive was dunked years ago, and we've got it working again, but we can't find all the files.
Oh, no.
So some are missing, some we'll have to add to, or some songs will be missing, that kind of stuff. But I am going to release I'll release it again in this series kind of thing, and release all the B-sides and rarities, stuff that never seen the light.
So online, or do you think you might do like different mediums and stuff like that too?
I'd like to do record as
records,
well.
Records very much the go these days.
It is, And obviously it'll go digital.
Yeah.
Go on all the Spotify's and iTunes and stuff like that.
But
look, I think there was some really good stuff in there and, you know, there'll probably be some members that will be like, how dare you release that? But
I want some money for this.
Yeah. You know, look, I think if there is any money, obviously it'll get passed on. But I think at least for people that did come to all those Rumblers gigs for all those years, you know, we had quite a big following.
You did.
We'd fill loads of venues. So
especially the Lansdowne. I keep on bringing up the Lansdowne because Dave's been notorious for putting holes in the ceiling at the Lansdowne.
Yes.
Isn't that right? But apparently that's not the only pub that you've done it to.
No, it's not. So what I would do, and I've actually broken a bass in this thing so that wasn't the Lansdowne, that was at the Metro Theatre.
Okay.
I think we did a headline at the Metro, and it was the last song there. So what I used to do was, like, I'd lean down, grab the bottom of my bass, and then throw the thing right in the air.
Yeah.
And I'd try and get as high as I could, and I'd always catch it.
Yeah.
Until the last time, and I didn't catch it. And the bass, it just went through my hands, hit the ground, and the back fell off.
Oh, no.
And it just twisted the body. So that's the one downstairs on the piano.
Okay, yeah. I was wondering what happened to that one. Yeah.
So that was that. Metro was its last gig, so I'm happy with that. It's, you know, I've got enough bases now that it doesn't need to be repaired, or it's just a good keepsake for myself.
Mm-hmm.
But then I'll try and do it in these smaller venues, and my measurements were never right. So often I reckon I've got about a meter, and it'd go into the roof.
Did it ever get stuck?
Yeah, it got stuck at the Lansdowne.
I can imagine them pulling it down.
There was a Melbourne venue. So we did it in a Melbourne venue, a couple of Melbourne venues and a Canberra venue too.
Mm.
And it wasn't like I was trying to do this, but it became a thing of people were like waiting for the bass to go through the roof.
Yeah, I always waited for
it. Yeah. But yeah, there was one that, if you know what a double bass looks like, which I'm guessing most of these listeners will.
I would hope so. Boy.
The curl on the top.
Yeah.
So it went through, and then it must have gone forward a bit, and it just hung on that.
on the little scroll. Yeah. So, the part, yeah, okay.
So I just played the rest of the song.
Just while it was hanging there.
Yeah, yeah.
That's fantastic.
And then just
that's rock and roll.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so I became a bit notorious for that.
You did, yeah. You have become, but you've calmed down a little bit over the years now.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
Just a little bit.
A little bit, yeah.
Where do you see psychobilly in Australia at the moment? Have you been out, because I know you live a very busy life. Have you been sort of able to sort of like see
any? No, not really, because it's in Sydney and like I'm gigging most weekends.
Yeah.
If I'm not gigging, I'm recording. Mm. And then a lot of the recording obviously has been under wraps.
Yeah.
We're recording this new project.
Mm-hmm.
Also playing in a band called Whistle Dixie, yeah, which is like a alt country. I guess it's not alt country; it's more old country. I would say.
Mm.
And that band seems to be touring a lot.
Yeah, it's really taken off a little bit, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has. We've been doing some kind of massive festivals and stuff like that. So mm-hmm. that's been really good. And that's who I took with Walt as well.
That's right. Mm.
So I took Casino Rumblers rhythm section as a backing band.
G'day, Simon.
Hello. And Jackson behind you.
G'day, Jackson.
And then Whistle Dixie as like the main support.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was good. It looks like we might be doing the States with Walt as well.
Oh, wow. So he's invited you over.
Yeah. To go on his new tour bus. Have you seen that?
I have seen the photos and I'm very envious of it. So that's a little bit different over there as well, isn't it? It's like you can actually tour on a bus. You can actually, everyone can sit on the bus and sleep whilst it's driving and all that. Yep. You're not allowed to do that here in Australia.
You're not allowed to, no.
No, you're not allowed to. Everyone's got to be seated and strapped in.
Okay. I have a new tour van.
Yeah.
Which we got about 6 months ago, and that's good, but it's seated. It's just a huge van. Basically.
It is. It's a massive van. I've been in it. Yeah, it's been good. But I personally, I'm, because this is the sort of thing I do, I'm really encouraged by a lot of the bands that are out there at the moment. You know, we both know Flame and Galahs. We know Jed and those guys really well. And, of course, we know Captain Reckless, but a whole lot. Other bands and all that sort of stuff that are sort of emerging there and are still sort of there as well. You know, they're really coming through and I'm encouraged by it.
Yeah.
I'm really encouraged by it because and I really hope younger folk come through too. You know, I really hope that, like for me when I was younger, I really hope that someone sees some guy slapping this double bass and thinking, man, that is freaking cool. I want to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I'd love to see more of that in Australia.
Yeah,
I'd love
for
to
sure.
see younger bands really getting into this really eclectic style of music.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, I'm hoping so basically, actually speaking again, how you going, Aaron? Reckless. when you were speaking to him, so he got back to some of the roots of Zombie Ghost Train.
Yeah.
And so I'm kind of hoping everything's in a cycle and I'm hoping that cycle happens again. So would you mind if I kind of head back as well?
Mm, please, yeah.
So, as Aaron was kind of saying, I can't call him Reckless.
That's okay. Just call him Aaron. That's all right.
Because obviously, I know who you're talking as he about. Said, he was in the original incarnation of the Rumblers.
And I was blown away. I did not know he played the saxophone.
Yeah. So, so when we started, so we were pre-Zombie Ghost Train, all that. So there was the band I was in with Stu, and then that disbanded. I can't remember what Stu wasn't playing, and I started this Casino Rumblers, and there was nothing in the country.
Yeah.
There was, you know, I was waiting for the Fireballs to reunite or, you know, because they were split at that stage. I'm pretty positive.
There was also another band from Melbourne. I think they were called the Cyclones, I think it was.
Yes.
Tyron Shaw.
Tyron, yeah. So he ended up becoming a manager for the Rumblers.
Oh, okay.
So they had finished by that stage.
Right, okay.
As well, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
So, and then there was the Howler Moondoggies. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether they had finished. I don't know. So, look, as far as I can remember, there was nothing.
Yeah, right.
You know, and I, as I said, I just kept wanting this harder kind of music and I wanted to go see a psychobilly band, but there was none.
There was none in Australia.
So right. I was like, well, I'm going to make it happen. So we kind of started this, started playing around Sydney because I had the in with kind of playing in the Sonic Aces with a few venues. So I just put on whatever, whether it was punk metal, whatever I could get. One thing as well that people don't know is the Rumblers had a lot to do with burlesque hitting Australia.
Oh, okay.
So I started kind of like looking to see what was happening in America, and the internet wasn't very big then and you could find little bits and it was kind of like, oh, you know, this burlesque thing that I've, you know, seen snippets of from over there. So I started putting burlesque in between the bands.
Okay, right.
So I'm pretty sure we were the first to do that. But Melbourne's different. Melbourne probably did that.
Yeah, most likely.
But as far as my world of what I knew, we kind of brought that to the table. And then we had a girl named Gypsy that started to dance in our sets.
Okay.
Sort of so she was really
poppy kind of way.
Yeah, pre-Horror Pops.
Way before pre-Horror Pops. Many people know who the Horror Pops are and they know that they had those go-go dances for a long time.
So she would do, there was two songs she'd do in our set.
Okay.
And then so we'd have other girls in the middle. So she was kind of finding us all these girls and it's like there's no one doing it. So she was roping girls in and teaching them and and then it became obviously a massive thing.
Yeah, wow.
So like I'd like to say we had something to do with it, not we had all to do with it, because there would be a lot of people like, hey, I was already, you know. We just added to the thing.
Partial pioneers.
Yeah.
You know, that's cool.
But it was good when, you know, then you'd have Bazooka Joes. I can't remember. There was also the Cyclones.
Yes.
Different Cyclones.
Different Cyclones, okay.
Yes. So there was the Cyclones from, where were they? Blue Mountains.
Okay.
So no double bass.
Yeah.
But they were a little bit along the lines. And Simon Weil played in that.
Yeah. Well, what band has he not played in?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the better question.
And then Paul O'Connor. Do you remember who Paul O'Connor is?
I think I remember Paul, yeah.
Yeah, so he was...
He was a tall guy, wasn't he?
Yep.
Yeah.
Wasn't our original guitarist, but I would say he was our main guitarist that did a lot of the big touring.
Yeah, I remember him, yeah.
So they were both in that band. And then... We played in the Blue Mountains. So I was just looking like, where can we play?
Yep.
It doesn't have to be Sydney. It doesn't have to be just Sydney and Melbourne. We're doing that. Where else?
Yeah.
So we were doing all these obscure gigs and I'm like, the more I can do, the more I can create these venues and get something happening there. And whether we keep doing it or other bands do it, my thing was just get an opening in this, and if that booker's like, oh, what a night, and they start putting stuff on, then we can come back and other bands can go. And so there's a place up at Katoomba we did a fair bit. The Empire, do you remember the Empire?
I remember the Empire, yeah.
So the Empire, when we first started, didn't do pretty sure either didn't do live gigs or didn't do punk bands.
Right, okay. I remember, because I do remember seeing you play at the Empire. I think from memory, which is terrible, you may have had the Stu Arkov Experiment doing something at that stage.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah.
I was drunk, but I remember it. Yeah.
That was so I'm pretty sure it was like... So I went in and at that stage we couldn't get into the Annandale because that was the big band thing and it was just up the road. So I'm like, can we start playing here, blah, blah, blah. So met the guy that runs it and he was like, yeah, for sure,
yeah.
You know. So we started a big thing there that was cool. That ended up quite the venue.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Annandale. Is the Monster Ball at the Annandale. That was one of my highlights. But I think one of my highlights of remembering going to the Annandale, was hearing that you had broke your ass at some point.
I had.
Yeah, you broke your ass. I think it was when the Meteors were touring. Is that right?
No, it was Madsen.
Madsen. I knew it was someone big, but I'm sorry to bring that up, Dave.
That's right.
You did break your ass, though, didn't you?
My ass and this crowd can finally meet. There'll be a few guys that know this.
How did you do that? How did you break your ass, Dave?
So what it was actually I had I'd formed these abscesses on my spine.
Okay. So it was quite serious.
Yeah, it was quite serious. Yeah. So I went to doctors here, and I had this shitty doctor back then. And mm-hmm. He's like, it's just hemorrhoids, you know. You're doing all this stuff and, you know, you're probably not sleeping and all this stuff. And you've just got hemorrhoids. So I was like, all right.
You're in a band. You're obviously doing questionable things.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, just push them back in and you'll be right.
I was having a sip of beer, Dave.
Which is the worst thing you can do for these abscesses.
Oh, yeah.
So I ended up, I had this surgery twice actually, but it was the Madsen tour. I basically nearly died that tour. So, where were we? I think we're in the Gold Coast. Staying at a promoter's house.
Yeah.
And I woke up, I was kind of like, oh, I've got to go to the toilet. Fuck, I'm in a lot of pain from these, what I thought were hemorrhoids.
Yeah.
And got Dad off the bed and my legs didn't work.
Wow. They just stopped working.
So yeah. I was kind of like, shit, okay. So I'm like, fuck, I've got to do something here. I cannot get them working at all.
Mm-hmm.
So yelling out to the other guys, I'm just like, I've got to go to hospital. Sirens going past if you guys can
it's
hear that.
It's typical here.
Hopefully
in
not.
So
I get to the hospital and they kind of dragging me in and drag me into a bed and trying to get me stand up and, you know, all right, try and get this working and just fall over.
Yeah.
Anyway, they'd do, it'd be x-ray or what do you call it?
Ultrasound
or something like that, find out what it was.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, oh, you know, I've been told I've got these hemorrhoids and, you know, now I can't walk. They're like, that doesn't sound right.
No.
So anyway, emergency surgery. So I'm pretty sure I missed that Sydney gig.
You did. Yeah, I recall you missed that Sydney gig and quite understandable too.
Yeah, so it was pretty major surgery because it's so what they'd done is like right at the base of my spine they'd stacked.
Okay.
And there was three or four of these things and they pushed against that main nerve.
Right.
And obviously infection was starting to spread and, you know, I just lost.
And once that happens, you really got to get onto it pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, but still me being me, I obviously missed that gig because I'd been out for the whole day.
Yeah.
And that night, I think it was, so like I was out.
Yeah.
Woke up, I had a 6 a.m. flight to Newcastle.
Mm-hmm.
So I woke up kind of middle of the night and was like, oh, shit, where am I? Yep, okay, yep, I've had this surgery. All right, what night is it? So I thought I was still going to make that Sydney.
Yep.
So that was phone days. So I looked on the phone and was like, all right, I've missed a gig. So I didn't even know at that stage I'd missed a gig.
Mm-hmm.
But I was like, all right, so ringing the band and seeing what's going on. Yep, we're on the way to Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
They'd booked me a flight. That's what it was. I'm trying to remember how it all went.
It was a while ago.
Yeah, it was a long time ago. And, so nurse comes in. I'm like, look, you're going to have to sign me out because I've got a flight to catch. And they're like, you're here for 6 weeks. I was like, no, I'm not.
No, I am not. Wow. 6 weeks.
Six-week recovery.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so they're like, no, this is pretty serious. Like, yeah, look, you're definitely staying. I'm like, I don't even live in this state. And, you know, I've got to go home.
I don't even know where my clothes are.
Yeah, I don't know, you know. Mm. So I'm like, I can't even get anyone to drop anything.
Yeah.
Or,
yeah.
So I'm pretty sure all the band took off. So I'm pretty sure it was just me.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, nah, you're signing me out.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise I'm going anyway. I'm on tour.
Yeah.
So the surgeon comes in and he's just like, Dave, what are you doing? It's like, you can't. And I'm like, I'm going.
I can.
All right. All right. I'm like, look, this is a big tour for us. And,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So it's like, all right, I'll sign you out. You've got to promise me these things. So without getting into too much detail, but there's like wound packing and stuff like that with spines and, you know, it's pretty full on. So it's like each city you get to, you're going to go to a hospital, you're going to get this wound dressed. And so I did all that, followed all the rules.
Considering the proximity of it as well, you know, you need to make sure you're not getting anything in it, you know, so
yeah,
absolutely. I get that. I work in the healthcare field.
Yeah.
Stuff doesn't disgust me. It may disgust other people, but not me. And I've asked this of Jed, and I also asked it of Aaron, as we know him. Your mental health over the years, how have you looked after that? Because I imagine being out on the road for excessive periods of time, you've got two daughters as well, and, you know, an absolutely lovely wife. It must be difficult to be out on the road. I imagine, you know, long time ago as well, like we're going back a few years, you know, where you would have been on the road for quite a long time.
Yeah.
How do you look after yourself then?
Look, I've always suffered with severe depression.
Yeah.
So diagnosed severe depression. I think that's maybe why I'm so busy.
Yeah.
I think I just fill my time.
You fill your time.
I fill all of my time that I can't think.
With the things that you love though.
Yeah. You know. Yeah, look, I can't be that guy that just works an office job or, you know, and I don't down that on anyone.
Mm.
It's just not the way my brain ticks. It has to be
a
passion.
Mm.
And then I will do this passion and learn it to the end.
Mm-hmm.
But what I can't do is then let go of that passion and get a new passion.
Yeah.
I just get a new passion.
And add it on and top keep of what the last them, one. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Which obviously I think mental health wise is probably not the best way to deal with it, but it's the way I have dealt with it.
It's the way you deal with it. Yeah. We all deal with things in very different ways, and I guess one of the real common things which I've learned from not just speaking with yourself and you know, guys like Jed and Aaron, but other people as well, is that music is probably one of the main ways that you look after yourself.
Yeah.
You know, with
and then obviously with tattooing, I'm creating as well.
Yeah,
have to be creating.
You've got someone with your mind. You've got to be creating. You've got to get it out there, or it just sits there and just becomes too much.
Yeah,
and you've got to let it all out, and it's absolutely wonderful when you figure that out.
Yeah.
You know, when you figure out this is the stuff that really helps me. This is my self-care.
Yeah.
You know, this is what I've got to do to look after myself, not just for myself, but for the people around me as well.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, because, you know, as I've said, you know, you've got two absolutely beautiful daughters, and you want to make sure that you're the best person you can be for them.
Yeah. Now I've got one starting to go to gigs and festivals.
How's that? Is that a bit weird?
It's all right.
Because I've got a nearly 12-year-old daughter as well, and you know, and she, I've brought her to gigs. Actually, my wife and I have made sure that we've brought her to any gig that she could go to.
Yeah.
But I look forward to the day that I can take her to an over-18s gig or something like
that. Yeah.
How's that, man? Is that a little bit strange? Well,
she's still under 18. She's still 16, she's starting to do the festival circuit and stuff like that, going to them, not playing them. But so I've got that worry now to add to it.
especially considering when I think back to when I was 16.
that's kind of what I was alluding to.
Thankfully, your daughter's a very responsible person.
She is. I guess I was too.
Yeah.
As I say, like 14, I was already starting to do tours.
Yeah.
How old
were you when you were playing with the when you were playing with
Wes?
With Wes. Too many 16. W's there.
16.
Really? And you were playing in clubs and all that sort of stuff?
Clubs, yeah. So I was just lucky I looked old enough and never got asked.
It's amazing what a beard does. For those who know, I've actually shaved off my beard that I've had for the last 12 years.
Yeah.
And it's unfamiliar but familiar in a way because I used to have killer chops back in the day anyway.
Yeah.
So it's Dave and I actually get we were quite often mistaken for brothers.
Yeah, that's right.
Because we looked very similar.
Both big and bearded.
Big and bearded and jolly as well. You know, always up for a good joke and, you know, whether it be filthy or not, most of the time they were filthy. Yeah.
One thing we got to I think we missed where that was going as well. The so from my butt story.
Oh yeah, sorry, yeah.
Back to so previous to that, I was saying, you know, we'd kind of found these venues and done all this stuff.
Yeah.
So coming back to that question of what do I think psychobilly and where it should be?
Yeah.
And that's it. Like you kind of said it last week about Jed and Flaming Glass, and he's not as young as what we were back then doing this kind of thing, but hopefully that's what I can kind of see is hopefully one of these bands gets on some, you know, there was Groove in the Moo just on here, which is like an alternative festival.
Yeah.
You know, gets this cool rendition of what psychobilly is and that it picks up again.
Wouldn't that
that's
be something?
That's what I can see happening.
I can see something like that happening too, especially when you've got such a charismatic band as well.
Yeah.
You know, it's like because there are a bunch of guys that don't stand still on a stage.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you get that so much with rockabilly bands and all that sort of stuff and everyone's just so sort of static and they just sort of stand there and do their thing. And whereas you were describing raucous rockabilly before. That's what it should be.
Yeah.
It should be dangerous, you know. Yeah, it should be in its and people want to be entertained as well. And
yeah, that's right.
There's something – you were doing it with the Rumblers when you were, like, putting the bass up and even when you were standing on the thing and all that sort of stuff. People love that shit.
Yeah.
You know, and then to be able to play the instrument at the same time, people think that's even cooler.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
I still throw it around, but I don't stand on it these days.
No, might need some. No, let's not
some
go
bracing.
There. I was going to say that, but I thought not because
need some embracing when I fall off.
I'm not exactly a small guy myself. So, look, Dave, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you.
We've been friends for a very long time, and you were probably one of the first guys that I thought of. You know, because I know. We're friends and I know that you would not be judging me on asking stupid questions. So I really do appreciate you taking the time, sitting, they're recording everything for me. I didn't have to do a damn thing. I didn't have to bring anything in because Jackson's an absolutely lovely guy. I've known Jackson for quite a few years now and we've gotten to know each other quite well. And you have got yourself an absolutely amazing crew around you. I just kind of really want to thank you for letting me be part of that as well.
That's
it's like I really needed it.
Yeah.
So, again, thank you so much. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast and I've had an absolute pleasure. Thank you. Cheers.
Thank you.